Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. Recent efforts to test blockchain's viability as a settlement and payment alternative are the first critical steps towards adopting the technology. Yet many questions remain about mainstream implementation. Read more at morganstanley.com/blockchain. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC. Member SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. Hello, and welcome to the latest edition of Politico Money. For this week's episode, I traveled to Stanford University to talk to Kevin Warsh. Kevin is a former Fed governor. He's a former senior economic advisor to President George W. Bush. He's now a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. We talked about his candidacy to be Fed chair and his interview for that job with President Donald Trump. He obviously ultimately didn't get the job that went to Jay Powell, but he had some very interesting things to say about his conversation with Trump about the Fed. We also talked about the economy, tax cuts, and a whole lot more at Stanford. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Kevin Warsh.
We're at the beautiful Stanford University campus in Palo Alto, California, at the Hoover Institution, where we are joined by Kevin Warsh, who is a former Federal Reserve governor, a big player in Republican economic circles, and was a serious candidate for Fed chair this time around to replace Janet Yellen. So we'll talk a little bit about the current situation at the Fed and interest rates and the economy and the state of the Republican Party. We'll try to keep it interesting and do it in 20 to 30 minutes. And Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, Ben. Thanks very much. I appreciate that introduction. I'm a has-been government bureaucrat, but you did a lot to try to get the attention of our listeners today.
Far from a has-been, always a player in GOP economic circles. And I should mention that Hoover is home to a lot of serious Republican thinkers, John Taylor and others in the economic and monetary policy world. So it's always a pleasure and a thrill to be here with all of them. So, Kevin, let's start and talk about the Fed and the Jay Powell Fed. And, of course, I have to ask you, you were up for the job. Were you super bummed that you didn't get it?
Okay, let me correct one thing. Hoover stands for a lot of things. I'd say one of it is there is certainly a deep strain of conservatism here. I'd say on the party side, you know, this institution, like a lot of institutions, there are people that are more involved in the GOP and the party. But really, if we're doing our jobs right, we're fighting about ideas. And the differences between and among us on the economic front are very significant. Some of them have implications for the Republican Party, for what Congress should be doing. But we try to define ourselves by the search for truth. And boy, oh boy, if you look around Washington these days, there doesn't seem to be a lot of that fight of ideas that's so top of mind. So that's what we try to do out here, and we're thrilled to have you here. To your much more substantive question about the Fed, I'd say I was equal parts disappointed and relieved. Listen, Jay is a good guy who I've known for a long time. He's a man of really high character. And my judgment is that is an important attribute for a head of a central bank, especially at this moment in time. And that high character is going to be tested because the next 3.5 years might be benign from an economic standpoint or a political perspective. I wouldn't bet on it. Yeah. And character matters. So, you know, I really do wish him the best. And I think once he gets his feet under him, once he's put his mark on this institution, you know, I hope he embraces the need to reform the institution. He doesn't just take it as it was and run through the next 3 or 4 years, and he's got the right background to do it.
Okay. We'll get into some of the challenges he faces both from a policy perspective and possibly from a political perspective. But I want to stick with the Fed selection process for a minute, and to the extent that you're willing to talk to us about it. You obviously went in to meet with President Trump and talk about the job as among the finalists for it. And I just wonder, you know, a little bit about what that conversation was like now that it's all said and done and it's not, you know, the process is no longer ongoing. What kind of questions did he ask? Like what was he interested in as it pertains to the Fed and monetary policy?
Sure. So I'm old-fashioned in a couple of respects. One of the ways I'm old-fashioned, Ben, that you know, as most of my colleagues in the crises went off and wrote books and put words in our mouths about what who said what at different moments. My judgment, maybe it's because I said, well, maybe at some point I'll come back into government. And the last thing I'd want to do is everyone to come into my office and write down what was said for their next publication. So I'm happy to give you a sense of it. But I think, you know, the questions he asked, I'll try to sort of keep those
sure.
relatively muted. But I would say a few takeaways. One is it's clear the president had interviewed thousands of people in his life. He knew what he was trying to figure out. You and I might say, well, that's not the right set of questions or that's not what the objective of the Fed is. But he knew what he wanted. The interview went much longer than anticipated, and it was a mix of high compliments and deep, tough questions. In the room with me was the Treasury Secretary, General Kelly, and then a couple of other aides to the president. He was sitting behind the Resolute desk. Most presidents in more recent American history go off in front of the fireplaces, you know, try to make the discussion a little bit more casual.
Sit on the couches.
On the couch.
Yeah.
But the president spoke and interviewed as the president from the Resolute desk. And for your listeners, of course, the Resolute desk is probably the most important piece of American furniture given to us back from the Brits after the War of 1812. And so you're right in there. It has been reported, and I guess, Ben, I can confirm that when I did walk into the office, it is true that he first said to me that he thought I was a very good-looking man. So that's as far as I'm going to go in the interview.
Very good. In terms of I have to probe you a little bit on the stuff that he was asking because people will wonder, was he looking for pledges from Fed candidates to not step on the economy too much with interest rate hikes?
So see if I can say this artfully and not dishonestly. The president has a view about asset prices and stock markets. He has a view based on his long history and his prior life as a developer and real estate mogul of the role of interest rates. So if you think that it was a subject upon which he delicately danced around, then you'd be mistaken.
Okay.
It was certainly top of mind to the president, and I'm sure that now Chairman Powell and I got hit with some very direct questions on that subject, and we both answered them as honestly as we could. In some sense, the broader notion of an independent agency. That's probably not an obvious feature to the president.
Mm-hmm. Did he indicate any basic understanding of the fact that the Fed is supposed to operate outside of political pressure, and or did that concept seem kind of alien to him?
So this might be a good time for a no comment, Ben.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Did he press the button to order Diet Cokes while you were in there?
No, I didn't see him press the button, but he was consuming one.
Okay.
I mean, again, your listeners will have different views of the president, but he has an enormous amount of energy.
He does. I don't think anybody in the audience would deny that.
Yeah. So, but he seemed to be quite happy with the one beverage, as I recall, during the meeting. And, you know, the meeting was a what's the Washington parlance, Ben, you would use for this? A candid discussion of views, frank and candid discussion.
that is perfect Washington parlance for it. And how long were you in there?
I think something like an hour.
Okay. Well, it's an hour on monetary policy with the president. That's an interesting thing, something you'd certainly tell the grandkids about and everything like that. Let's jump into Jay Powell and the current state of the Fed and the idea that there is going to be an inherent tension between what the president wants, what the White House wants, which is the economy to run as fast as it can after the tax cut plan got pushed through and goes into effect, and perhaps Powell and the Fed not wanting to step on growth, wanting to get all the benefits from faster wage hikes and more manufacturing and all that stuff, but keeping an eye on inflation not getting ahead of their 2% target. And we're now we've had one rate hike this year. The question is, do we get three or four? And the big overarching theme that's out there now is, can the Fed let the economy run a little bit hot? And that might please Trump and the White House. Can that happen? Can the Fed let the economy run a little hot now?
So there's a lot there. I think there's a great William F. Buckley description for all that was loaded in that question, Ben. He said there used to be a lot of, there's a lot of undistributed middle. So let me try to break that up. First, I know that there's breathless talk about will the Fed add another dot? Markets wonder whether there'll be 4 rate increases this year or 3, showing how much I'm out of step with the consensus. I can't think of something less important to the state of the economy, even the financial markets themselves, but whether they add a dot. But that does seem to be the, I would say, overly narrow preoccupation of a lot of leaders in monetary policy and maybe even inside the White House. For a very long time, the Fed set short-term interest rates and had only passing effect on long-term rates. Those were set in markets. With the advent of quantitative easing, which we made up in the financial crisis and is now standard operating procedure, I think too many are of the view that we have to control the entire treasury curve. We should be setting all these prices. Whether the Fed raises rates 3 or 4 times this year, in my view, because the quantitative easing is ending, 10-year yields are going to do what they're going to do. And if I were in a position of authority, which, Ben, you know I am not, I would say the Fed's control over that is not anything like it's been for the last 10 years. So I think this preoccupation is wrong. Secondly, I would say the president's interests and the Fed's interest should be aligned in the following respect. What's going to happen to the economy in the medium term? To the president, he might say, I want to know what the economy is going to be when I'm up for re-election 3 years from now, 2.5 years from now. Well, that's a medium-term focus. The Fed should be thinking over the horizon. What I think would be more disconcerting is if the Fed was thinking about what's happening to the stock market today. If the president's thinking what's happening to the stock market or bond market today, that myopic preoccupation I think isn't good for either of them.
Yeah, okay. But that idea of inflation running a little hotter, like it could go over 2% and we'd be fine. It's not that big a deal. Is that true?
So I think the preoccupation with this hard inflation target of 2.0%, and again, the decimal point there is really just for kicks. Mm-hmm. We don't know the difference between 1.6% annual increase in prices or a 2.3%. The data is not good enough. Our assessment of the data is filled with noise and subject to revision. In my judgment, we've been running consistent with price stability now for several years. The idea that we're waiting on a change in wages from the Department of Labor, whether it goes up by 0.2% or 0.3%, suggests to me that we're focused on the wrong issues. But if I were to get through this and buy into the framework, which is quite at the vanguard, I would say I think the Fed is comfortable letting inflation run above 2.0 by a tenth or two for a little while. Though you wouldn't know it from their statement.
No.
What's the word in the statement? Symmetric?
Yeah.
Symmetrics, I think, means something very different than markets believe. Symmetric, at least the way I understand the word, is the Fed had been missing its inflation target by more than 0.5%, if you believe their framework, for more than a year. So if you really had a symmetric policy, you'd let inflation run at 2.5 or 2.6 for the next year. Hmm. I'd be shocked if the Fed means that. And I certainly don't think that markets have anywhere near that anticipation. If markets believe that, 10-year yields would be materially higher. Inflation risk premium would be materially higher. So again, I think they're focused on this wordsmithing, but the wordsmithing I think is causing a bit of confusion.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the tax cut plan for a minute. Obviously, cut corporate rates quite significantly, cut individual rates to a degree as well, though not made permanent yet. My first question is, you know, the Steven Mnuchin argument is that we will get so much growth from this that it will in fact pay for itself and that these forecasts of $1 trillion annual deficits and, you know, $30 trillion in total debt over the next – by the end of next 10 years are bogus, that the growth is going to take care of everything. Is that true?
I wish our understanding of economics was good enough. I'd say there's a few problems with those assertions. One is in economics, we aspire to be a real science like physics or chemistry. we're probably a little closer to political science, which is what you cover more frequently, what happens in Washington.
That's mostly theater, actually.
Yeah, well, welcome to economics.
Yeah.
So we're running two experiments at the same time. So we're running a supply-side experiment by changing corporate tax rates materially, by allowing full expensing, by having some reform on the corporate side of the tax code. I don't see fundamental tax reform embedded in the individual side. And so there'll be people on the right who say this is a supply-side experiment. Let's see if it works. And regardless of the results, some of them might jump to conclusions. We're also running a pretty aggressive demand-side neo-Keynesian experiment by a huge spending bill.
Yeah.
So if we see 3% growth in the next four quarters, which I think we will see, instead of running that as an experiment about which economic policies work, both sides are going to run to their corners and say, you see, I told you so.
Mm-hmm.
I think the neo-Keynesians who have been in control of economic policy for the better part of the last decade, they're going to say it's not sustainable. It's not supply side. They'll call it a badly timed government spending. They'll assign huge multipliers to it and say, well, it's going to end in 18 months. And those on the right will be dismissive of that. And they will say, you see, we've changed potential. I'm afraid the experiment won't be a controlled experiment, so we're going to have a hard time drawing conclusions. My own judgment, for what it's worth, is Washington generally overstates the demand-side benefits of government spending and understates the supply-side changes that good government policy could have. I'm an optimist in that I do think that you're going to see by the second half of this year a big increase in capital expenditures outside of residential. This has been anachronistically low in the last 10 years. It can fundamentally improve productivity and wages. So regardless of one's view of the merits of this, I think you're going to see the biggest improvement in wages in 2018 that we've seen in more than a decade. You're going to see a material change in inequality towards less inequality. And they'll be screaming about the politics, and I wish that the economic experiment could be a cleaner one.
Yeah, I mean, cleaner you mean by not driving up deficits with more government spending.
Right.
That you would have a pure supply-side experiment if we just did the corporate tax cuts and some of the individual tax cuts and we did not have this increase in
a substantially clearer supply-side experiment.
Yeah.
We've been running the demand-side experiment from 2009 until the end of 2016. And it has failed. I know that it's common to call this – it was common to call this the new normal and secular stagnation and the U.S. can only grow at 2%. I don't believe a bloody word of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the economy is capable of much more. What mediocre policy creates is mediocre growth. What much better economic policy could create much better growth. But I worry that 18 months now from now, everyone's going to run to their corner and say, you see, I told you so.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's say, you know, the CBOs of the world are correct in their predictions for the 10-year trajectory of debt and deficit. And we, you know, get to the point where we're trillion plus every year in the deficit and pushing 30 trillion on total U.S. debt. Paint the scenario for us. How does that impact the economy? Why would that be a bad thing to do?
Well, I think it impacts the economy first in that, again, contrary to many of the leading lights in the profession, we're not great economic forecasters. So we don't know when the next recession is. And to the extent that we have used up our fiscal space by running these deficits in peacetime, and to the extent we've used up a considerable amount of our monetary policy space – because this normalization that began in 2010 is the slowest normalization in economic history. If there is a shock, even an overseas shock, it connects through financial markets, it connects through trade and capital flows. Are we prepared to respond with credibility and a strong arsenal of tools? I fear we're not. So the first way that impacts us is in the likely event that the next 10 years are not benign. That is, you get a series of shocks, some of which are totally unanticipated, that both the U.S. and most of our trading partners around the world who have copied our policies on monetary on the monetary front, who have copied many of our policies for better and worse on the fiscal policy front, the global shock absorber doesn't exist. Second, I would say if you do have a benign period, I think that the most forecasters are wrong in two respects. One is I think that the idea that interest rates in the next 10 years through a benign cycle, which we will assume here, won't end up being something like the post-war average, I think, is wishful thinking. I don't believe in the new normal for growth. If you look at the next 12 months, I think growth can be strong for good reasons. And I think there's no reason to believe that all the good stuff's been invented. So productivity over the next 10 years could be just as high as it's been through most of the post-war era, and we might have come out of a period that is anachronistically low. So that assumption changes almost everything, and I just suggest that having a robust discussion at the Fed's next press conference of what is productivity, how does that relate to real rates, how is that the most important issue, might be more fertile ground than are we going to add a dot or not.
Less dot plot, more productivity and what it means. And
more what are the big issues?
Yeah.
You know, you've got the finest economists in the world at the Federal Reserve, and it seems to me to be awfully trivial to be focusing on three or four. But to your other question, Ben, about the other assessment, I think that the CBO and most blue chip forecasters, they again assume that interest rates are going to be something like 200 basis points below on average over the next 10 years, over the full maturity of the Treasury curve of what they've been over the last 60 years. Boy, that's heroic. So let's assume that instead of an average rate of 3.5% for the next 10 years, the average rate is 5.4%, which is the post-war average. Those trillion-dollar deficits you're talking about, they look like nothing. Mm-hmm. And so you can see where the politics in Washington come to infringe upon the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve has some say over that. My view, of course, is I want to keep the Fed as far as we can out of politics. But if you end up in a situation where quantitative easing the world over is more normal, not just used for cataclysms and global financial crises, you could see why there'd be a very uncomfortable set of congressional hearings between the fiscal policymakers and what are supposed to be monetary policymakers.
Yeah, indeed.
We'll be right back with more of my conversation with Stanford's Kevin Warsh. But first, a word from our sponsor.
A message from Morgan Stanley. Attracted by the potential for lower processing costs and stronger security for a range of transactions, financial players are testing blockchain's viability as a settlement and payment alternative. But meanwhile, many questions remain about mainstream implementation and the challenges ahead. Development and deployment costs could be high, potentially more than simpler alternatives like updating legacy infrastructure. In addition, computing, bandwidth, and storage requirements may grow exponentially and will need to be seamlessly integrated between blockchain protocols and legacy systems. Read more at morganstanley.com/blockchain. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
Let's talk for a minute about trade. You talk about potential shocks to the system, one thing that people worry about. And I've just come from the Milken Conference in Los Angeles, and it was, you know, topic A, B, and C were the steel and aluminum tariffs that the administration has put on and then given some significant exceptions to. And now this mission that's going on now to China from senior administration officials. Talk to me broadly about your view on the administration's approach to trade and its invocation of tariffs, both on aluminum, steel, and now threatening them on the Chinese and the potential for a trade war. Are we headed to a trade war?
So first, Ben, I'm gratified that those substantive discussions were at top of mind at the Milken Conference. From afar, I wasn't there, but I thought it was how happy Tom Brady was going back to the Patriots to his depleted backfield.
There was a little bit of that, too. Okay. And Goldie Hawn meditating.
All right, good. I hope you didn't have to compete in your panel against all those pop stars.
Listen,
I think the G2 relationship, the relationship between the U.S. and China, is the most important economic relationship in the world. We might wish that weren't so. We might try to wish it away. We might say, I wish my global supply chains looked differently. But by hook or by crook, we are deeply embedded. So I spend most of my time trying to assess what's happening to the G20 economies. And the dirty little secret is if you really understand what's happening in the U.S. economy and you really understand what's happening in the Chinese economy, you can impute the other G18. So this military aircraft that comprises half a dozen or so of the president's senior economic advisors heading to China, I imagine instead of sleeping, they had a robust dialogue over exactly what they could agree they are for. I suspect they offered those views frankly and forthrightly to the Chinese leadership. And it is in both countries' interest to resolve this. With each passing month between now and the fall, I think it gets harder and harder to resolve. And I hope that on our side that we have a proper sense of the scaling and relative importance of each of these issues. So while there might be a lot of resonance to changing a tariff on American autos that are going to China, and certainly a lot of political resonance to agriculture shipments, those two things in and of themselves alone don't do a lot to this bilateral trade deficit that everyone's making such a big point of. So scaling the importance of what matters to the U.S. is really important. Scaling what matters to the U.S. and is in our interest 5 and 10 years from now is at least as important as what's going to happen between now and the election cycle. If we are stuck with fighting over a bilateral trade deficit, there are, I'd say, prudent ways in which we can deal with that and some politically convenient. Let me just suggest to you, Ben, a prudent way. That bilateral trade deficit is largely around products. The U.S.'s comparative advantage is certainly in some products, but it's certainly in services. And services need not be a proxy for Wall Street. Services is everything from entertainment to logistics to audit and law, everything else. That's our comparative advantage. That's where our economy has shifted naturally over the course of the last two generations. And I would suggest that if we offered these services to the Chinese, where frankly they are in need of these services, these have hardworking Americans standing behind them, we could cut the bilateral trade deficit markedly if they'd agreed to let these penetrate their markets. If we have a staid view that all that matters is products and all that matters is one trade deficit, it will be hard overnight to change the global supply chain of products. And the more important question is, will that fundamentally change and improve the fortunes of Americans in the next 5 years? I think that is less obvious.
Yeah, and that just begs the question, does this one bilateral trade deficit even matter that much? Does this one trade deficit matter, and do trade deficits matter at all?
So there's an old story which, you know, while we're here at Hoover, that I think I first heard Milton Friedman, the finest economist of the 20th century, tell. And so I'll be paraphrasing. He said that he kept going to his barber even when his hair was somewhat slighter in his later years. And he kept building up a bilateral trade deficit with his barber. And the barber raised the price and Milton kept going. The barber was willing to take him. The deficit went up. The barber was happy and so was Milton. Mm-hmm. So I guess we could get rid of the bilateral trade deficit, but the barber would be worse off because he'd miss the entertainment and the knowledge of Milton and the $22 he'd pay, and Milton wouldn't get such a good haircut. There are a lot of things in economics about which we can't be certain. But again, I wouldn't prioritize a G2 bilateral trade deficit as the framework by which we should judge the importance and the difficulty of the most important great power relationship for the next 100 years.
Yeah. What is it like for you and for other conservative, we won't use the word Republican, conservative economists who, you know, believe in supply side economics, believe in free trade, to kind of interface with this administration that has kind of turned a lot of that on its head? Like, what do you make of it? How do you deal with it?
Well, I'd say it's fair in that I think the fights that are happening inside the administration, which I read about from you and others, they're not that different than the fights that have been happening at Hoover for the last 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. So there is a tendency in Washington among people that we both know who think of Hoover with this broad brush as if we all believe the same thing. My goodness, economics has further to go as a real science than virtually anything else that we practice. And so I hope we have the right fights. I would say for most of us, this is certainly true of myself, when I get summoned to Washington or to the White House or the administration, I happily go and I give them my best views. If we're not summoned, we don't try to knock on the door and have them let us in. So it's different interfacing with this administration. And I think each of us here at Hoover, as you're going to find over the next day or two in covering the conference, some of us think that we're making traction and others have thrown up their hands and said, I'm not leaving Palo Alto again for that.
Yeah, right. I think there's a certain amount of that, the attitude about not wanting to go into this administration. Just to go back to the China thing for a minute, and people will probably be listening to this after that trip is come and gone, but how weird is it that the people on that plane don't agree with each other? I mean, obviously, all administrations have internal policy disputes and then eventually coalesce around a policy and sell it to the public. But you've got, you know, Steven Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, Larry Kudlow, all going over there, Bob Lighthizer. And there are enormously divergent views among that group on the efficacy of protectionism and tariffs and the benefits of free trade. It just seems really weird to me that we would send a team over there that has such internal disagreement.
So two things. One is I think because of the nature of this administration, for better or for worse, we are probably more aware of the internal fights that are being had in this administration than we were in predecessor administrations, where at least the ones that I'm familiar with, the fights internally were ugly. And 90% of them were hidden from the press. So I think there's a huge divergence of views. I wouldn't try to sugarcoat it. But we're probably seeing more of it here than we would have under President Bush or President Obama. I think the most important thing going into the meetings in Beijing, or as your listeners are hearing coming out, is that someone on that plane was empowered to speak for the president. Doesn't bother me at all. In fact, I'm quite encouraged if they're having a hard fight about bilateral trade deficits and the U.S. role in the world and the G2 relationship. It's high time that we had those kinds of fights. But the leader of the free world has to then empower a person and a set of ideas to speak to the Chinese with clarity and with confidence and have the other people say, yes, that is what the president wants us to achieve. And if no one is empowered, then that gives a negotiating leverage to the Chinese and something we should not do. So my sense of things is, and this could be belied by what happens next week when they come back, my sense is that this is not going to have any easier short outcomes. Punches are being thrown in both directions, and it's likely to be a tougher negotiation for a while. The other thing, Ben, that I have to note that strikes me as an outsider that's different is normally I went to China on behalf of the government for the first time in 2002. I've negotiated a bunch of communiques around meetings. The odd thing is most of this is usually the work is done at the staff level. When the principals get together and certainly the presidents get together, you've negotiated, figure out almost everything, and you're checking back with your president. It might be quite different this time. It might be that the staffs go and sort of rough each other up and have offers and counteroffers. But that at our side, it's the president who actually wants to negotiate this deal.
Yeah.
That's a very different dynamic. And for the people that are on that airplane, I think it makes it just a different way of doing business for them and for their Chinese counterparts.
Yeah. And we're going to get pulled out of here soon because I know you have other important things to do. But I want to just touch on a couple other quick things. And that same point is true about NAFTA. At Milken, I was talking to officials both from Mexico and Canada who said, you know, they like Bob Lighthizer. They like talking to him and working on getting this renegotiated deal. But they're never quite sure if what he says represents what the president is ultimately going to agree to and endorse. And they don't necessarily feel like they have an empowered counterpart. And that's just a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem because you end up with less strong outcomes. I think the U.S. trade rep has going for him, and I'm going to let you and your listeners draw a contrast maybe with other parts, is the U.S. trade rep has dedicated career professionals that have been through these fights for a generation or more. They know the fights. They have the data. They have the specifics. My suspicion is that they have a comparative advantage on data, knowledge, and history. And so I don't exactly know who's speaking for the administration in the NAFTA negotiations, in the Korean-U.S. negotiations, in the G2 negotiations. But the guys that's got the troops and the knowledge usually ends up having a particular comparative advantage both with the president and with counterparts. So that's an advantage perhaps in comparison to some other agencies that might be lighter in the bench here. Yeah. 15 months in the administration. Yeah.
Okay. So you were in government in the financial crisis when it really started and took hold. Give us quickly the scariest moment from the financial crisis.
So, you know, the fog of war makes it hard. I don't remember really sleeping for about 2.5 or 3 years. What I think – and I give Chairman Bernanke enormous amount of credit for – the scariest moment is, you know, when we found that the U.S. banking system was, to put it indelicately, insolvent. Contrary to some of the advice and counsel the chairman was offered by some of his some of the people around the table in positions of power in Washington early in the crisis, who thought, yeah, you had a problem with this bank, you had a problem with that institution. But when the chairman came to the view, which I must say I had an instinct, having come from one of the banks, that some might be more solvent than others, but they're all in some sense following the same trade. So if one is deeply insolvent, the other might be less deeply insolvent, but they're at the other end of the queue. Once the chairman figured that out, he did something which would otherwise have been scary, but he did it with a calm hand. What he concluded was, every Sunday night before Asian markets open, we need to roll out a new product.
Yeah.
And I would often come to his house on Thursday or Friday and have a gluten-free dinner and say, well, here's kind of where the staff are. Here's our best idea. I don't think it's a very good idea. And his conviction that if it's a good idea, that'd be great. And if it's an okay idea, that's fine too. And so he'd punch back. So he deserves a lot of credit for the darkest days of the crisis, of keeping calm. And, you know, in some sense, we were so tired. We'd been working it so hard that we didn't realize only in retrospect how scary some of those moments were. My own biggest concern from all of that is we actually didn't learn as many lessons from the crisis as we should have. If I look at our regulatory system today and I say, after most crises, there's a bunch of firefighting and there's a bunch of reform, I see plenty of firefighting that we did. We had disagreements internally, but as fighting fires go, I think we did a decent job. How fundamentally different is how we view the largest banks in the U.S.? Not fundamentally different, I fear. How fundamentally different is monetary policy now, 9 years after the darkest days of the financial crisis? Are we still preoccupied with price stability as if that's the same thing as financial stability? I worry about that. Are we still preoccupied with little questions waiting for data from the Bureau of Labor and the Department of Commerce? Fear we're still doing that. So I think we've gone back into some old habits. And before the environment gets less benign, this is a heck of a good time to start reforming things, better late than never.
Yeah, and the last thing I want to ask you is just about Trump in general. Do you think he'd be better off if he tweeted less? And what do you make of all the kind of really serious personal attacks on people on Twitter and just the general aggression that he brings to the White House?
So you've wandered well outside my area of expertise. I don't even have a minor in politics. I would say generally that Trumpism and populism strike me as very different things. And I believe that the view coming out of the last elections was that the country could do better. And they were willing to take a shot, you know, not knowing exactly what it meant, on some kind of radical change. And the instincts of the American people to do that are right. We'd been on the wrong path for too long in successive administrations. And so the president in the first 15 months has a window of opportunity to do things that fundamentally improve wages and improve incomes. But in the world of economics, we do have a tendency of forgetting about other things like culture, other things like work ethic, like civility. And if at the end of 4 or 8 years we want to say that this was a radical choice but one that was successful, we need both a stronger economy and we need a bit more civility in our political discourse, because even in economics, it is harder today than it was 2, 4, 6, and 8 years ago to have a serious discussion about what a different tax cut proposal would mean, what a view would be on too big to fail. And I worry that the lack of civility is finding its way even into the nerdy business that we do of economics.
Wow. Uncivil, nerdy economists. Not something that anybody wants to see on any given day. Kevin Warsh, thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and looking forward to the rest of the conference here at Hoover.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Okay, that's a wrap for this week's edition of Politico Money. Thanks so much to Kevin Warsh for joining us. Thanks to my producers, Bridget Mulcahy and Micaela Rodriguez. Our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're enjoying the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. And if you've got questions or ideas for a future show, you can always tweet at me, at Morning Money Ben. Love getting the feedback and all of your good ideas. And we'll catch you next week.